Well, now to the lies we tell ourselves and what they tell us about ourselves. Our guest is the best-selling American author and essayist Eula Biss, who in her new book, Having and Being Had, looks at the psychological effects of consumerism and what it means about who we are and how we see ourselves. Within this framework, Eula scrutinises our tendency to monetize everything, the baggage that comes with buying a home, gender, class, and more, through her own distinctive form of personal essay. Eula says there's perhaps no bigger lie in her home country than that unfettered capitalism is a functioning system. Eula Biss is with us from Chicago. Welcome, great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Having and Being Had, the title of the book, grew out of you buying your first home, which made you feel uncomfortable. In what ways?
I think it felt, because the home was new to me, it felt excessive. By American middle-class standards, it's not excessive. It's a two-bedroom house for a family of three. But moving here from an apartment, it felt like so much. And in comparison to what other people in my community have, it also felt like so much. Very early in the book, there's a moment when a woman rings the doorbell, a Mexican woman with four children. She rings the doorbell because she's noticed from the street that the front room in our house is completely empty, and she wants to know if she can rent it. And her interest is in having a family of five live in the front room of the house. And that was a reminder to me of how much space I had and how that space would be used by someone else.
You also write early in the book of your partner, I think. I'm not sure. Is he your husband, John? What should I call him? John.
Yes, a partner or husband, okay. Either works.
John, I think, got the phone call from a company that wanted to use the house in a commercial. And as often happens with you, Eula, I think one incident, one event can lead you on a whole strand of thinking. What was this part of the story? Again, fairly early in you getting to know your new home. What was this about?
Yes, this was, to me, a very strange turn of events, but it came from the fact that our house was formerly inhabited by an actor and a set designer, people whose livelihood revolved around the theater and acting. And they had made extra money by renting the house out as a set for commercials. And so we, very soon after moving into the house, we got a call from a casting agent wondering if the house was available for commercial. And at first we laughed at this idea and said, no, it's not available. We're in it. But then we found out that we'd be paid a very lot of money for allowing the house to be used for 3 days, around the sum of $8,000. So we ended up agreeing to this commercial, and the commercial was for Walmart, which is a huge corporation. It was banned from doing business in our area for quite a long time because of protests over their low wages. But had started doing business around Chicago, where I lived, shortly before this commercial was to be filmed. And so a set designer and a whole crew came in. We vacated the house, and they started to make the house over to look, as they told us, like the home of an African-American grandmother. And this was notable to me because our house is identical to the house next door. And in this identical house next door lives an actual African-American grandmother. So one of the things we noted was that we're a white family living in a house that's being made over to look exactly like the house next door and also being paid money for it. And one of the observations that a friend of ours made was, I think that's the definition of white privilege.
This experience of having contradictory feelings of elation and hesitation, because it is, perhaps regrettably, a privilege increasingly to own one's own home and to have all the solidity that that can represent and the security, particularly when caring for others. But you found yourself just with these contradictory feelings. Was this what led you to start writing a diary?
Yes, very, very early, very soon after we moved into this house, I started taking notes. It was somewhere between a diary and notes on my new life. And I was keeping notes because I knew that the feeling of discomfort that I had would fade with time, that this extraordinary new life would come to seem ordinary to me. So yes, I was trying to note the moments in which I felt uncomfortable and to observe what it was that made me uncomfortable, but also to observe why I was in this life, what I was delighting in, what along with the discomforts, what were the comforts? Because that's where I saw there being something of a bind. The comforts of being not just in this house, but being in the kind of financial security that the house represents were a draw to me, even as I was repulsed by certain aspects of the system in which I had acquired this house and these comforts.
One of the matters about Walmart, of course, is the ubiquity of these stores that, at different price points, sell us dreams and name to sort of like, if you furnish a house with X, and then there's a sort of a completeness to it somehow. There's an artificiality to that. In fact, it's even more explored in your IKEA catalogue chapters and thinking. And what is there a harm in having a dream? Is there a harm in having a dream of a house that you own and lovely things in it? And if there's not fundamentally a harm, what have we done to it?
Yeah, I don't think it is inherently a harm to want a thing or have a thing. I think that the harm is in the what is largely invisible system behind how we acquire things and the people whose labor is used or poorly compensated in order for some of us, not all of us, to afford the things we have. So there's a moment in the book where I reference a book called A History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. And this book is partly about the cost of cheap things. And part of the cost of cheap things, they're made cheap often by other people's labor being more or less stolen. So I think that that's where the harm is. And for the middle class, the upper middle class in the U.S., the harm that is being done to other people is largely hidden from us. And so we're allowed to think that there's really no harm in having a comfortable life, that it's not costing anyone else anything. And so part of the project of this book was for me to look very closely at my life, to try to just listen carefully, look closely, and try to identify the places where harm was being done to someone else in order to afford me what I have.
To someone else, but also in some ways to ourselves.
Yes.
You write of the baggage that comes with home ownership too, which is that this feeling that creeps over you in a furniture shop, for example. Again, where those fortunate enough of means, and sometimes going beyond their means, can walk in and have all you can eat. And again, in this situation, you found yourself discomforted. Could you explain more deeply what it was?
Yes, yeah, and this is a different kind of harm. And this harm was new to me. I had newly arrived at a kind of financial security where I could, for instance, buy new things. I had the experience of being in a furniture store was new to me. I'd never bought new furniture. And what I found very quickly is what many people already know, which is the experience of being a consumer has an emptiness to it. There was not tremendous satisfaction to be had in acquiring things like furniture. And part of that was because of the kind of emptiness of what was on offer. But part of it is the emptiness of the promise. I think we're surrounded by messages and promises that we will feel some gratification if we acquire certain things, including a house and furnishings for it. And it's not that some things aren't nice to have or don't make one's life better or more comfortable, but that it's not a replacement for the truly gratifying things in life. Throughout this book, I was also trying to track the things that fed me as a person and an artist. And that's why the book is built around so many conversations and exchanges with people. And that's where in my life I find real gratification, is in these non-monetary exchanges with other people, mostly through conversation.
It's a consciousness that imbues your experiences that possibly drives you a bit mad at times, I imagine. But and again, this creation of want / need. At one point, you're having an issue over what colour to paint something, you know, which I'm sure you would be the first to dismiss as a very much a first world problem. But the fact that you find yourself in that situation, the fact that we have had created for us, or that we create for ourselves, and put value on things well beyond the necessity, is part of this, again, a reflection on the system as much as a reflection on an individual? Or is it the marrying, the knowledge of the system, of the individual and the individual psyche?
I think it's likely both, but what I was interested in this book was really in what I could see of the system from my own experience and from my own life. And so I was less interested or concerned with my individual failings or faults or foibles than I was with what the system was doing to me and to my life. And much of what I saw or noticed had been previously quite invisible to me. It took a real conscious searching and looking to see what was happening, not just to my everyday lived experience, but also my psychology. And that was probably some of the most disturbing work in this book, was looking at how the system at large, and when I say the system, I mean the kind of capitalism that I live within, this economic system, how that system had shaped my own thinking, and how much of the values and the logic of capitalism I had internalized.
What was one or two of the hardest realizations?
I think one was realizing how much I had internalized the idea that what has worth, what's worthwhile, is what earns money. And so, and as I realized how much I had internalized that, I started trying to change that attitude. So for me, this is a very dangerous attitude to have as an artist, because art making and writing does not reliably produce money within capitalism. Art is undervalued. The kind of writing that I do sometimes makes money and often does not. And so I realized that I had been shorting myself on time to write and undervaluing my own work as an artist. because of how much I had internalized this sense that of where worth lay. And so I do play with the words worth and worthless in the book a bit. I look at the things that I do in my everyday life that are not earning activities, which is actually, you know, quite a bit of my time is spent in non-earning activities, including parenting. And so in the book, I play with the idea of my child being quote unquote worthless. That is just a play on language. Of course, my child is worth very much to me. But in financial terms, raising a child is a money losing endeavor. It's not worthwhile by the logic of capitalism.
It's reminding me of Thoreau, who explored just this point about the value of things and a different way of weighing up value in a monetary sense versus benefit. And the two do not necessarily align. Personal benefit, the two do not necessarily align. There's a moment where you cite another writer, actually. I'm just going to say Elizabeth Chin, who says, and I paraphrase, people are so completely and powerfully alienated that they are reduced to things which acquire the livingness that people have lost. I don't sense that this is acute for you, but do you observe it perhaps in others?
I do. I see it all around me. And Elizabeth Chin's a very interesting writer who's an anthropologist. And she went on to say something along the lines of, it's cars that are sexy, for instance, not people who are sexy. Or it's we've kind of projected qualities that are innately human qualities onto objects around us. And there is a real, there's a sadness and a loss there when objects start doing our living for us. And she's talking, she's also summarizing Marx there and talking in somewhat Marxist terms. But it felt true to my lived life. And I'm surrounded by people who pour their best energy into working jobs that are unsatisfying and draining to them and are kind of leached of their livingness in order to afford the things of their life.
Let's talk about money, which people don't like to do, which is exactly what you explore in the book. And tell me about what happened when, was it your sister you were talking to, about the cost of the house and the financials of it? There was a profound discomfort that you chose to break through. Elaborate, please.
Yes, I was joking with my sister, only somewhat, actually. I was half serious, half joking. But I told her that I'd realized that what I'd done was buy a $400,000 container for a washing machine. And I said this because it seemed to me that the washing machine more than the house had changed my life. This was a wonderful new amenity for me. But what I noticed when I wrote that moment down, when I committed it to paper, was that I had rounded down really dramatically the price of my home when I was talking to my sister. It's closer to $500,000 than $400,000. It was $485,000, but I had rounded down to $400,000, and it disturbed me to see that I had lied to my own sister about the price of my home. My sister, who knows everything about me and with whom I'm very open. And when I noted that, I made a rule for myself in this book that from that point on, every time I mentioned a sum of money, I would make myself name the sum of money exactly on the page. I wasn't going to allow myself to work with half-truths or rounded-down numbers. I decided that I was going to have to work with the exact numbers to prevent myself from giving in to the temptation to minimize what I had or hide it in some way. And I think that's very much a habit of the upper middle class, is minimizing what you have and hiding it and dismissing it. So I forced myself not to do that on the page.
Why is this the case? You have written about incredibly personal matters, and you detail them and remind us of them in the book. Why was this one so hard? Why is it such a matter of sensitivity? And it's not even about it not being polite. There's something deeper that is perturbing. What do you believe it is?
Yeah, I don't fully know the answer to that question, but I've been thinking about it throughout the process of writing this book and still now after. I was very caught off guard by how uncomfortable, deeply uncomfortable, excruciating even it was to name the sums of money involved in my life, name my salary, for instance, the amount that my father paid for me to go to college, even the sum of money I paid to buy a necklace in one scene. All of these were really surprisingly painful moments of what should be just kind of workaday honesty. And I think part of it is I started asking myself, well, okay, where does this taboo around talking about money in specific terms come from? And I think part of the answer to that question is, well, who does it serve? And I think silence around money serves the people who have the most of it best. And I think that it's a social taboo to talk about money, in part because that protects the people who have more of it than everyone else. It hides the extent of our inequality, our social inequality, our economic inequality, and it protects those who have the most from being found out, first of all, but also from having to confront what they really have. You know, in writing this book, I realized that I had far more than I was aware of, even, and that was a little bit of a disturbing realization.
You came to conclude you were rich, however that is
Yes.
measured. I think it's lovely when people have rich, we feel like they're rich, and they do not have a lot of what is independently sort of verifiable, measurable means. But by saying rich, I think you realised finally you looked around you and realised what you had comparative to others was way more than perhaps you'd assessed earlier. Can we talk a
Yes.
little about that middle class? I'm really interested to hear you talking about upper middle class and middle class because I want to talk about the American middle class.
Yes.
But just before, can I ask you this? Has the experience of COVID in 2020 caused you to rethink or to think even more intensely about some of these matters?
Yes, it's for me, it's very much underscored everything that felt to me to be the heart of my examination in this book. Part of what I was trying to look at is the quiet ways in which the middle class and the upper middle class is served by people who are under-resourced, undercompensated, insecure, in meaning lacking health care or some essentials. That's been, you know, people keep using the phrase laid bare, but it's been laid bare by the pandemic in the US. It's now abundantly obvious. When I was writing, I felt there was some subtlety to this. There now doesn't really seem to be all that much subtlety to the dynamic. It's people like me who are well-resourced and middle-class professionals get to stay at home and protect our health while our everyday needs are serviced by what we're now calling essential workers who are delivering goods, stocking grocery stores, providing health care. Many of them are very poorly compensated and do not have access to health care themselves, and or have relatively poor access to health care. So I think some of these inequalities that were less obvious, harder to see before the pandemic, are brightly underlined now.
What is happening to what we call the American middle class, some of whom seem to be doing okay or better, others of whom seem to be, and you referred to your mother about this, we'll talk about that in a moment as well, at one point in her life, others of whom seem to be falling out of it. And this is not as a result of COVID necessarily. This is a result over many years and has perhaps formed part of your political tumult in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
How do you even define the American middle class now? Its values and what it is. And what is
yes.
its health?
It turns out to be such a tricky question how the American middle class is defined. By any definition, it's a huge group. It's a tremendously large category by almost anyone's definition. It's also, by almost any measure, majority white. But different people, economists, sociologists, government officials, census officials have different ways of thinking about and measuring the American middle class. Its boundaries are very fuzzy, unclear. Probably the clearest and best measure I found was from an academic who argued that that household income is a fairly misleading way to measure the middle class, and that what we should really be looking at is net worth, meaning your net worth is your debts subtracted from your assets. And by that definition, the middle class falls between a net worth of zero and around $400,000 or $500,000. So again, that's a vast spread, and having a net worth of zero is obviously a very different psychological and material life than having a net worth of $500,000. But when it comes to the question of the middle class shrinking or being threatened, this is something that politicians bring up all the time. The idea that the middle class is threatened, endangered. I think that this stokes a sense of fear and economic insecurity in the middle class, a sense of being right on the edge of not having enough. But this, at least in pre-pandemic numbers, the middle class in the U.S. was shrinking slightly, but it was shrinking because more of the middle class were becoming rich. So that is not what I think people imagine when they talk about the middle class shrinking, but it is an indicator of the country becoming more and more stratified, more unequal. The inequality is growing in this country.
Do you see it changing? And a difficult question given your politics at the moment, your particularly polarized politics, the vested interests who are able to have such say in the system. But the kind of capitalism that the country is experiencing at the moment that you say is, it's a lie to call it a functioning system. Is this inevitable? Do you have optimism about the kind of change that could rescue everyone, I think, from its worst excesses?
Yeah. Well, what did give me optimism was actually digging into some of this research on economics. There so often our economic system is talked about as if it's entirely independent from human beings and follows some rules that are dictated by the stars or the universe, the rules of physics or something. When in fact this system is made by people, for people, and if it's not doing what we want it to, we can change it. And reading economists who repeatedly emphasize that did give me hope, actually. And economists like Piketty, like David Graeber, like the author of The Value of Everything. These are economists and thinkers who are arguing for the possibility of us making policies and laws and practices so that we can build an economy where what we value as a society is also economically sustained. So for instance, if we really value the education of children, we can make the policy decisions that will support the work of teachers and will compensate that work much better, and that will create a better environment for children. And, you know, a number of countries, including New Zealand, I think are ahead of us on some of these practices and policy decisions. So we also can see what's possible from what's out there in the world.
This is ultimately a personal book, and how has writing it changed you and the way you live?
Yeah, it is very personal, and it was important to me to lash every question I had about capitalism to my lived life, in part because discussions of economics can become so abstract and so abstracted from everyday life. So I wanted to write a book in which I used everyday life to think about money and economics, and write a book in which neither I nor the reader could ever forget that there was a lived life going on behind these questions, or in front of these questions in some cases. And writing it did change my life quite dramatically. The book charts some of this, and some of it is more of a subtext. But over the course of writing it, I made the decision to step down to part-time in my job, for instance, and to make less money. I decided that I had enough, and that if financially, and that I wasn't going to devote my life and my time to making more. So I became somewhat downwardly mobile, I guess you could say, in the process of writing this book, in that I actively decided to make less money.
Thank you, Eula. Eula Biss, the latest book is Having and Being Had.